Salam and good evening to you, worthy friend. Please, please, come closer.
Too close, a little too close.
This is Julie Andrews. Once upon a time, there was a magic kingdom made of hopes and childhood fantasies. A timeless place where every land was filled with wonder. A place where everyone who entered its gates would be given the gift of the young at heart. The power to wish upon a star and unlock its magic. Are you ready to wish upon a star? Then it's time to open your heart and remember, dreams come true.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Disney Brit Podcast for November 2008. We have loads of great segments to bring you this month, as well as our usual mix of entertaining and informative segments. This month's including our usual news and rumours. We have an interview with the co-author of the unofficial guide to Walt Disney World, Len Tester. We have our trivia quiz. We have an email from a listener this week about their experience about taking their autistic child to Walt Disney World. We have some information on the Disneyland Paris height restrictions. I bring you my review of the brand new High School Musical 3 movie. We have our usual hints and tips. We have also an interesting segment as the closure of Pleasure Island happened back in September. I thought I'd look back at it and bring you the history of the story of Pleasure Island. And also, I want to bring you another update about my book, The Imagineering the Way, The Unofficial History of the Magic Kingdom. The Disney Brit Podcast would like to thank Attraction Tickets Direct and Complete Orlando for their continued support. Complete Orlando are here to help simplify your Orlando holiday. They specialise solely in arranging holidays to Orlando and can therefore provide you with expert advice and knowledge on this magical destination. They have expert staff available 7 days a week and can personalise your whole itinerary using their huge array of hotels, private villas and apartments to suit all budgets, as well as car rental, scheduled flights, theme park tickets and travel insurance. Their whole product range can be totally tailored to offer complete flexibility and fit your individual requirements. You can find out more by going to www.completeorlando.co.uk or call them free on 0800 294 8844. Attraction Tickets Direct are an affiliated company with Complete Orlando. They recognise that people nowadays want to be free from package holiday restrictions and want to avoid paying prices inflated by travel agents' commission. Because they don't sell through travel agents, they are able to offer attraction tickets at unbeatable prices and offer expert advice. Furthermore, the service they provide is second to none since their lines are open 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 7 days a week, and customers receive their tickets within 7 days, and there are no hidden extras such as credit card fees or postal surcharges. Attraction Tickets Direct also offer a price match guarantee. You can find out all this information through their website, which is www.attraction-tickets-direct.co.uk, or call them at 0845 130 3876. So without any further ado, let's get on with the show.
Good morning, sire.
Good morning, Zazu.
Checking in with the morning report.
Fire away.
Mm-hmm.
Hello and welcome to the news and rumours for this month's show. We've got quite a bit to get through. I've got quite a bit of rumours to get through, specifically about Disneyland Paris this month. So let's start off with our news then. Just to very quickly start off with, Complete Orlando and Attraction Tickets Direct are offering two fantastic offers at the moment. The free dining plan that I mentioned on previous edition of the show that was available to UK guests has now been extended to the 2nd of December 2008. There are two options that Complete Orlando are offering. There's the free quick counter service dining plan. If you stay at a moderate resort hotel, you receive the Disney quick counter service dining plan for free. And this dining plan is great for those who want to maximise their time in the park and want a quick bite to eat. What's included then? Well, you get two quick service counter meals, two snacks, and one refillable resort mug per stay. If you are staying in a deluxe resort, however, or a deluxe villa resort, then you will be getting the free Disney dining plan. Now, this plan is perfect for those who want to be a bit more flexible and they want to have, you know, sit-down waiter service meals. If you take the Disney dining plan, then you have the chance to trade in your table service meals for character dining meals or meals at Disney signature restaurants or a Disney dinner show. And included in this, per person per day, is one quick service counter meal, one table service meal, and one snack. Also, just to remind you that all Attraction Tickets Direct are also still offering the 14-day Ultimate Disney ticket for the price of 7 days throughout 2009. And this amazing offer is bookable up until the 4th of November. So you've only got a few days left to do this and get this sorted. And it's for arrivals between the 2nd of August and the 3rd of October 2009. So please don't miss out on that. You can obviously contact Attraction Tickets Direct at www.attraction-tickets-direct.co.uk or by calling them on 0845-130-3876 or also going to www.completeorlando.co.uk for your dining plan or ringing them on 0800-294-8844. Disney have announced the last of the Super Soap Weekends that they've been doing over at Hollywood Studios, and it's going to be on November the 15th and 16th of this month, and this will be the final time it will be held in Hollywood Studios. Next year, there will be something known as the Soap Nation Tour. Now, this doesn't include any UK soaps, but I'll read you the press release Disney recently released about this. It says, also joining the stellar lineup of 30 stars from the ABC daytime dramas are Thorsten Kay, Aidan Turner and Rebecca Budding from All My Children, Erica Slezak, Michael Easton and Christine Alderson from One Life to Live, and Lauren Wright, Kelly Monaco and Jason Thompson from General Hospital. Soapnet.com will reveal the full Super Soap lineup, all a star lineup, on Tuesday, the September 30th, so that's now available. These mean nothing to me whatsoever. We don't have these over here in the UK, so I have no idea who these people are. But this year, special trivia and commemorative clip packages honouring the 45th anniversary of General Hospital, the 40th anniversary of One Life to Live, and All My Children's 10,000 episode and past Super Soap Weekends will be shown during the event. Super Soap Weekend will become more interactive than ever before with the introduction of new mobile programs and text trivia. A special musical number will be developed by Colgate Total Street Jam that honours the final event as well. Throughout the weekend, fans will have the opportunity to meet favourite stars from All My Children, One Life to Live and General Hospital. Festivities include celebrity motorcades, autograph sessions, game shows, interviews and the chance to purchase one-of-a-kind memorabilia for each of the shows. The Colgate Total Street Jam will close the event each day with live musical performances by some favourite daytime stars. Colgate Total Toothpaste has served as a presenting sponsor of the event for 9 consecutive years. If you want to find out some more information about Super Soap Weekends, you can go to the Disney website, and also about the 2009 tour that's going to be going on, you can go to www.rockthesoap.com. Disney have released some information about the Epcot International Flower and Garden Festival for next year, and it's going to be taken on the theme of Cinderella-bration, and there will be toperies featuring 4 Disney princesses dressed in blooming finery. and will set off the scene for the 16th annual Epcot Festival. That's going to be happening on March the 18th to May the 31st. So it's a slightly shorter run than it was last year. Cinderella and Prince Charming, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, Sleeping Beauty and Prince Philip, and Belle and Beast from Beauty and the Beast will debut as the grand front entrance topiary during the 75-day festival. Prince Ariel from The Little Mermaid also will greet guests by the front entrance fountain. Loads and loads of information about the highlights from the festival, including the Disney Gardening at Home presentations. There's going to be the family-orientated Growing Future Gardens. It's going to be a garden of delight where kids and parents get colourful and tasty planting ideas. There's going to be the Flower Power concerts. As always, they're going to be happening every Friday, Saturday and Sunday at 5:15, 6:30 and 7:45. And the concert lineup currently includes Davy Jones, Paul Revere and the Raiders, Jose Feliciano and other top acts will be named in not too distant future. If you want to know some more information about the 16th annual Epcot Flower and Garden Festival, then you can ring 407-W-Disney or 934-7639 or by visiting disneyworld.com/flower from the beginning of February 2009. The festival is including all gardening programs and exhibits, and also obviously includes regular Epcot admission. Atlanta Braves have also released their spring training dates. The Major League Baseball team are going to be coming to the Champions Stadium for their 12th season as spring training, and they're going to be there in March 2009. World Marathon Weekend has also been announced and is coming up. It's going to be held and presented by Cigna, and it's going to be on January the 8th to the 11th of next year. From what I understand, it is already full, but obviously it's going to be a very busy weekend there, January 8th to the 11th next year over at Walt Disney World. Across the coast over to Disneyland for this next bit of news, and this is to do with the Disneyland Birthday Club. Now, if you go over to disneyland.com/birthday club, you can sign up there. Not anything to do with actually going to Disneyland itself, it's all linked to the What Will You Celebrate 2009 celebrations, and on your birthday they will send you a birthday email along with some virtual balloons, streamers and virtual cake, and even some virtual candles for you to blow out. So over there at disneyland.com/birthday club, go over there and sign up. Okay, so we're going to take a tour through the different parks to give you the news from each one, and we're going to start off over at the Magic Kingdom. And the new Tinkerbell meet and greet is now open in Mickey's Toontown Fair. So you can go over there and visit Tinkerbell and three of her friends. I've forgotten their names off the top of my head. But if you want to see some photos and look at an article about that particular meet and greet, then the Orlando Sentinel have created an article, and that's over on their website. And what I'll do is I'll post the link to that webpage over in the show notes for this month. Epcot has now closed its 25th anniversary exhibition. I'm really disappointed I didn't get a chance to go and see this. Heard some great things about it and really wanted to go over, but unfortunately it has now closed. But on the other side, the other good news is the Nine Dragons restaurant over in China has opened nearly 2 months ahead of schedule. Rumours and reviews from several people I know I've heard have said that it's excellent, that the service is excellent, the food is excellent, and it's, you know, continued to be a really, really good addition to Epcot. The audio in Test Track has also been updated and now includes the new sponsor OnStar. OnStar is an American company, somebody who's not available over here. But over in Interventions, they've been doing a lot of work over there, what with the addition of Stormstruck recently and the new Velcro What's Your Problem exhibition. There is a new website that Disney have launched to give a bigger profile to Interventions, and it can give you all the information you need to know about the exhibits that are in there, some of the changes, the things that are going on. And that is over at interventions.disney.com/site. Again, I'll put the webpage over in the show notes for this month so you can go and have a look. But like I say, the site does include videos and photos of the different exhibits, plus a map of both Epcot and Innovation, so it's quite interesting. Hollywood Studios. There are some interesting changes that have been happening. It's believed that because of the downturn in the economy and the expected downturn in attendance at Hollywood Studios and some of the other parks, some of the operation hours have changed slightly. It is believed that Indiana Jones Stunt Show and Light Motors Action will no longer be offering Fast Pass. This, from what I understand now, is to do with all shows in Walt Disney World that currently have Fast Pass. They will no longer be offering it to guests. Honey, I Shrunk the Audience Kids Playground is now going to open around an hour and a half after park opening. One Man's Dream will close earlier. It's expected to close around 3 p.m. Sounds Dangerous will likely open at around 2 p.m. each day. And the Backlot Tour is going to be stopping running each day at around 5:30 p.m. But where there are things closing early, there are new things coming to Hollywood Studios, and the new High School Musical 3 show has debuted over at Disney's Hollywood Studios. Cast of 14 singers and dancers, and they're again out on the street, very much like they are in the other shows. And guests are going to be treated to a total of 6 original songs from the movie, including the finale to the film High School Musical. Also, Christmas is getting very, very close, and Disney have announced the dates for the Osborne Family Spectacle of Dancing Lights this year. It's going to be from November the 28th to January the 4th. From I understand, that's slightly later than it has been in previous years. It is again presented by Sylvania, and the guests are going to be treated again to all of those lights, sparkling snowflakes, the angels, trees, the twinkling bells, etc., and Santa with his reindeer. And I recently listened to an interview over on WDW Today podcast. They were talking to one of the creators of the Osborne Family Spectacle lights, and apparently they have a cat of which they have in different places each year, and it's one of the things that people sort of go to look for and look at for the Osborne Family Spectacle lights. So that's on from November the 28th to January the 4th, 2009. Okay, and the last of the park related news for this month, just to let you know some of the rehabs and updates that are going on over at Walt Disney World. The first one is quite a major rehab, and that is the Hall of Presidents is going into refurbishment from the 1st of November, and it's not expected to open until the 1st of July 2009. Now, that seems a really long time for me, for that ride to be closed. But it's apparently due to an extensive interior renovation, as well as obviously the changes to the show to include the new president. And it's also unclear as to whether the show will stay exactly the same. There are rumours that the new president will take a bit more of a background role, and actually President Lincoln is going to come forward and become sort of the main character within that. Over at Animal Kingdom, Primeval World will continue to be closed until the 15th of November. And finally, Typhoon Lagoon is going to be closed still until the 21st of March 2009, but Blizzard Beach will still remain open during that time. News about Downtown Disney then. Firstly, although it's not specifically related to Downtown Disney, Palmicky, the interactive soft toy, I know I have one, and it was great fun when I took him to the park, he has now been discontinued. The interactive plush was introduced in 2003, and although Palmicky will be no longer available for purchase, he will still be able to be used in all 4 theme parks as he already does. Palmicky will continue to be sold until the current stock has completely run out. So don't worry, if you do have a Palmicky you were thinking about taking with you to your next trip, you can. He will still work. You just won't be able to buy a new one if he goes wrong. Down in Downtown Disney as well, we have the Festival of Masters coming up from November the 7th to November the 9th. And again, as usual, 150 artists are going to display original creations. And this is the 33rd year that the Festival of Masters has happened at the Walt Disney World Resort. And this year it's presented by Sharpie. And this recognised art show is ranked among one of the country's best outdoor arts festivals that's held each year. To qualify for the Festival of Masters, artists will have had to have earned a primary award in their juried arts festival within the last 3 years. And prospective exhibitors submit award verification and samples of their art to a jury of art experts who select all of the participants. Now, the show this year is going to include sculptors, jewellery, painting, photography, glass and digital art, as well as several others. Street painters from the Florida Chalk Artists Association will decorate around 6,000 square feet of sidewalk with unique drawings. But youngsters can also take in part with the fun with live music, face painting and interactive kids zones. The House of Blues will celebrate the creative spirit of folk art during the 10th annual Where the Art Meets the Soul Folk Art Festival at Downtown Disney at the same time. If you would like to find out some more information about that, you can go to www.disneyworld.com/artfestival and also ring 407-824-4321. The Cherry Lane Fine Arts Gallery in Delgany, County Wicklow, Ireland, will also, I forgot to mention, have artists associated there. Now, the festival is going to be open from 9:30 till 5:30 each day, and of course, admission is complimentary. The T-Rex Cafe is now officially open, opened officially on the 14th of October. The restaurant is staying as a walk-in until the end of 2009, and then ADRs are going to be made available in the new year. This could have something to do with the ADR system switchover that is coming online by the end of the year. I know there's been some delays with it, but that is coming very, very soon. Finally, in the Downtown Disney news, the New Year's Eve information for Cirque du Soleil has been announced, and they are doing two special shows for La Nuba down in Downtown Disney at their Big Top. The show is going to be at 6 and 9pm. There's going to be a special New Year ending to the show, and again, tickets can be purchased at disneyworld.com or by calling 407-939-7328. Disney have announced the Christmas celebrations that are going to be going on this year over at the resort, and in Epcot, a special version of Illuminations Reflection of Earth is going to be going on, and it's going to have the usual original score and show. It's going to be presented at 7:40pm and 11:50, and the park's December 31st operating hours are going to be 8am to 1am. Disney Hollywood Studios is going to host Fantasmic at both 6:30pm and 8:30pm, and you can follow that with some live performances by in-park band Mulch, Sweat and Shears, and there's going to be a DJ playing tunes over at Mickey's Sorcerer's Hat. A special lights, camera, Happy New Year fireworks show is also going to bring in the new year at 11:30pm on the 31st. The park is open from 9am until midnight on December 31st. Those people who are going over to the Magic Kingdom and they're going to be there and they're late nighters, then they can go and enjoy the parades and the fireworks over there. The park is going to be including the Mickey's Once Upon a Christmas Time Parade. That's going to be on at 12 noon and 3pm. The Spectrum Magic Parade is going to be on at 7pm and 10:30pm. The Holiday Wishes is going to take place at 8:30pm. And then there's going to be a grand finale fireworks show, Fantasy in the Sky, which is going to be 11:50pm. And on December the 31st, the park is open from 8am to 1am. Over at Disney's Animal Kingdom, it's going to be open from 8am to 8pm on December the 31st, and guests can enjoy one of the final presentations of the Romping Character Cavalcade, Mickey's Jingle Jungle Parade at 3:45. Disney, of course, have announced the Very Merry Christmas Party dates. They are starting in the middle of November, November the 10th, 11th, 14th, 16th, 20th, 21st and 30th, and December the 2nd, 4th, 5th, 7th, 9th, 11th, 12th, 14th, 16th, 18th and 19th. Parties are going to start from 7pm. And they're going to include the usual entertaining Christmas additions. It's going to be the Castle Dreamlights, the parade, fireworks again, meet and greets, some tasty treats, snow on Main Street USA, and usual Magic Kingdom attractions. Tickets are going to be $42.95 for 3 to 9, and $48.95, obviously plus tax, for ages 10 and over. Day of the event pricing is going to be $7 more for each ticket, so make sure if you are going to be in Walt Disney World around this time, you make sure that you definitely get your tickets ahead. They can be contacted on 407-W-Disney or visit disneyworld.com/holidays. One final bit of resort news before we go over to Disneyland Paris. That is the Fort Wilderness Resort and Campground has started a archery experience. It's for both resort guests and non-resort guests, and it's going to be a 90-minute experience. It's going to cost $25 plus tax per person. That includes instruction and equipment. And if you are thinking about doing that on the selected afternoons it's going to be on, you can book ahead by calling 407-939-7529. Moving on over to Disneyland Paris then, we have some news for you from there. Discoveryland has a new information board in place, and this new enlarged board has a version of the park map which is just Discoveryland, and it gives details of wait times for each attraction in Discoveryland as well as show times for The Legend of the Lion King. Each attraction or restaurant has a corresponding number and letter, as with the usual park map, to show guests where each ride is and, you know, whereabouts it appears on the particular map. There's a picture of that over at Photos Magique, and I will put a link in the show notes to that. Mickey's Winter Wonderland set is being put up now, and Belle's Christmas Village is also being constructed. And also, I'll put a photo link over there in the show notes for that as well. The height restriction for Autopia has actually increased from 52 inches to 54 inches. When you listen to the Disneyland Paris height restrictions segment later, it does still say 52 inches. I recorded that before the information changed, literally in the past couple of days changed. It's now 54 inches. Now, this is not just in Disneyland Paris. It's apparently happening all Disney parks. And instead of you being having to be one to ride it, you now have to be at least 32 inches tall rather than it being based on age. A new information point is opening near Disney Village. It is being constructed next to the current Tourisme building just outside the train station. And King Ludwig's restaurant, although not specifically owned by Disney, is also having a new extension, believed to be a new bar. I have photos of all of those, courtesy of Photo Magique. I will put a link to their website on this month's show notes. Walt Disney Studios then, we have the lineup for the Stars and Motorcars parade that seems to have changed slightly to what it was. Latest information seems to lead to the following lineup, and this is believed to be what's going to be the final lineup as well. There's a new final lineup's going to be Aladdin, Disney Villains, Donald and Daisy, Lilo and Stitch, Mary Poppins, Mickey, Minnie and Goofy, Monsters Inc., Mulan, Snow White, The Little Mermaid and Toy Story. And also you'll notice that Star Wars is no longer there, as well as the new vehicle that was going to be Pirates of the Caribbean, which used to be the Muppets, Finding Nemo, which was Playhouse Disney, Cruella, and Cruella de Vil, which she will not now take over the Disney Villains car. Jack Sparrow has apparently been exchanged now for Donald and Daisy, who opened the parade in their vehicle, and the Playhouse Disney and Star Wars vehicle are not going to be used at all in the event. I did find some interesting information in the fiscal year report for Disneyland Resort Paris. It says, in line with our ongoing development strategy in the Walt Disney Studios Park, Playhouse Disney Live on Stage will provide the opportunity for our younger guests to join friends with the Disney Channel in an immersive entertainment experience for the launch of the summer season. So it's looking like that's going to be a summer release. Also says the park will also debut Disney Stars and Cars, a new Hollywood-style show starring characters from Toy Story, Snow White, Monsters, Inc., Mulan, The Little Mermaid, and more. So it looks like Disney Studios are really trying to become more family-friendly and trying to, you know, create more things for children to do, as there's a lot of adult orientated attractions in Disney Studios, not so many for kids. A new event is also starting over at Walt Disney Studios. It's called the Disney Terrorific Night. There's not massive amount known about it. It is debuted on October the 25th, and the idea is that the park is open from 1 a.m. Rather than the usual 6 p.m. close. And although this is very close to Halloween, it is not a Halloween event. Over at dlrptoday.com, I'll put a link in the show notes over to that, there was an interview that was held recently, and although it's debuting during Halloween, it's not going to be just a Halloween event. It looks like it's going to be something that's going to be happening regularly. It says that it's going to be going on through Disney Studio One. You'll be able to experience your favourite attractions with a brand new angle. Ghosts will appear in the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror. It's it's been suggested that the Studio Tram Tour will stop and ghosts will get out of the woods. It's going to be extremely fun. Vampirella will perform a one-of-a-kind concert on the production courtyard stage, and all finishing with a disco party in Studio One. Now, guests will be able to learn the choreography of Thriller and be able to dance just like Michael Jackson. And the background music of the park will be all different, creating a new ambiance, especially thanks to lots of smoke machines located everywhere. Hopefully this is going to be, you know, really interesting. New costumes, new masks, and it's going to be in the very Halloween sort of tradition, and it's going to be scary and fun. So it's not necessarily something that's specific just for for adults rather than for kids. It is a Disneyland Resort Paris exclusive. I am off over to Disneyland Resort Paris at the end of November. I'm going to try and find out a little bit more information about this new night. Maybe it'll be going on while I'm there, which would be great if it was, and hopefully I'll go and attend that and see what that's like. But also another interesting event that's been announced, and that's the Princesses and Pirates event that's going to be happening next February. Little else is really known about that, other than it's a Princess and Pirate event taking place in February next year. It used to be the carnival at that time of year, and they've now obviously bringing this idea over from Walt Disney World. Ride closure then in Disneyland Resort Paris over the next month. You have Big Thunder Mountain is closing from the 3rd of November to the 14th of November, and It's a Small World is closing from the 17th of November to the 28th of November. Other news then coming over from Disney, specifically for UK guests, this one. The voice of the speaking clock is to be replaced with an actress in the role of Tinkerbell from Peter Pan. This is now up and running. I have rang and listened to it. If callers ring 123 for the BT service, you will hear the new voice for the next 3 months. And this started last Sunday during the changeover to British summertime. It was partly to mark that, and also to mark the new Tinkerbell movie that's due out over here in the UK on the 10th of November. Now, this deal will temporarily replace Sarah Mendes da Costa with Mae Whitman, who also plays Tinkerbell in the film. BAFTA nominations have been announced for the Children's Award. And Disney, once again, as always, are ever present. Feature films, up for feature films this year are Ratatouille and Wall-E, up against Horton Hears a Who and Stardust. In the international category, Phineas and Ferb have also been nominated. In the BAFTA Kids Vote, which is a vote that the kids are able to give for television, website and short film, Disney are present in all three. They have got a nomination for Hannah Montana and Phineas and Ferb in the television shortlist. In the website shortlist, Disney's Club Penguin has been given a nomination. And in the feature film shortlist, there are nothing short of 4 nominations for Disney. There's The Chronicles of Narnia Prince Caspian, Enchanted, Ratatouille and Wall-E, all up for nomination there. Okay, then let's look over at the rumours for Disneyland Paris. These are rumours that some have been around for a little while. I haven't mentioned them yet. But like I say, they are rumours. They are things that are not necessarily being cleared up by Disney themselves. They are some that are ideas. Several websites have been talking about. Some have come from Disney people themselves. But just to let you know, these are rumoured plans for Disneyland Paris between 2009 and 2013. So for the next good few years. Apparently Walt Disney Studios is expecting to have a massive improvement. Although it's had an expansion over the past 18 months, they're hoping to improve it greatly a bit further. The Hollywood Boulevard they've created is going to be expanded, hopefully in the future, and this means that the tram tour station will need to be moved. There is a rumour that a Pirates of the Caribbean scene is going to be built as part of this backstage tour. But also, one of the big rumours is that Toy Story Mania is said to be coming to Walt Disney Studios, and the rumours are that it's going to be replacing the Armageddon special effects show. Now, one of the longest rumours that's been going about is about Soarin', and apparently they were thinking about putting it in between Cinemagic and Stitch Live. This rumour's still sort of floating about, but they've now put the queue for Playhouse Disney and obviously Stitch Live queue being where it is, it's going to be very difficult to squeeze Soaring in there, so it may be that they're going to think about moving that. Toon Studios are expecting some new attractions possibly, but it's going to be a slightly different feel to it. There's a piece of lawn in between the Toon Studios and Tower of Terror, and they said that they're going to be some funfair style attractions with a possible retheming to Pixar movies. There's rumours that an octopus star ride, you know, think about Destructor from The Incredibles, or Mr. Incredible stretching arms and legs and that sort of idea, with vehicles attached at the end for each of his arms and legs. There's also a rumour that a parachute-style attraction linked to Toy Story's Little Green Men is going to be appearing. And these three minor attractions are expected to be built around 2010 if they happen, in line for the opening of Toy Story 3. One of the more substantiated rumours is the talk of a brand new dark ride that's going to be open in France, and that is a Ratatouille dark ride. It was extremely popular in France, and it is looking that it may be towards the end of 2010, it may be a little bit later, but the idea is guests are going to be shrunk to the size of Remy, are going to be chased through the kitchen by Chef Skinner and his cohorts. The attraction is going to play with scale throughout, and there's going to be a four-man ride vehicle that's going to careen through the world of Ratatouille, and this is apparently had received approval from John Lasseter, and the idea is they're going to be using the ride system from the Honey Pot tour over in Tokyo, I think it is. But as part of this, and a part of John Lasseter's involvement, there's this sound that's going to be the Toy Story Land, is what it's being called at the minute. It's going to provide another five kid-friendly attractions and a meet-and-greet area. And the theme is likely to be something linked with Woody's Roundup from the fictional television series that is linked with the two movies. And it's hopeful that they're going to expect Toy Story Land will give guests some extra attractions linked to the third movie. And again, thoughts that it may open by June 2010. It's 2 years off yet. Disney haven't really released anything in the future. But again, this is going to mean an alter to the tram tour route. Over in Disneyland Park, there are again rumours that the Little Mermaid attraction opened in Disney, that's going to be opened in Disney's California Adventure and possibly Magic Kingdom, is also going to be coming to Disneyland Park. There was a version of the ride that was originally slated to be put in for the opening of Euro Disney, and it is actually featured on the Little Mermaid DVD. This is going to be a very different version. It could be built near the Fantasyland Festival stage, and they might pull that down. But again, this is rumours. There's nothing specific to go on. But there is an interesting space over at Fantasy Festival Stage, especially as that's only used at times during the year. But also, the Toad Hall restaurant next door seems to have shut its doors. So again, that's another space that isn't being used that could possibly become something. With the Fantasy Festival Stage being pulled down, there is then plans to build a new one. This could be a similar sort of thing to the Storybook Theatre over in Hong Kong Disneyland, and it could be built between Fantasyland and Discoveryland on the pathway between the two. Other big decisions for the park. There is rumours that they are trying to choose between two particular new attractions for Disneyland Park. Either Splash Mountain to be built in Frontierland, or removing the Chaparral stage, which is where Tarzan's show is at the moment, and putting the Indiana Jones Adventure in Adventureland. And there's possibility that this is going to be happening for the 20th anniversary of the park in about 2012. The Grand Floridian and Animal Kingdom Lodge have both had their additional wings put on them, and there's talk that both the Sequoia Lodge and the Disneyland Hotel may get the same sort of treatment over in Disneyland Paris. But again, this is something that is just rumour, but it'd be nice to see some more space over at Sequoia. Sequoia is a beautiful hotel, one of my favourites over on the Disneyland Resort Paris property, and it'd be great if they actually did do that and added some more wings onto the main part of the hotel. Few changes down in Disney Village. Also rumoured that there is apparently going to be a Starbucks coffee shop put in there. I know Starbucks is certainly having difficulty establishing itself over in France. And also an Earl of Sandwich is possibly going to open soon. And a few concept art sort of models have been around on the internet of a large World of Disney superstore that is going to be opening and replacing some of the stores in Disney Village themselves. Well, there you go. That is news and rumours for this month. Quite a lot there to talk to you about. Quite a lot of news. And say the rumours do sound really exciting, and I really hope that these are all going to come to fruition. Some of them may, some of them no. But until, obviously, Disney give us some actual confirmation, then who will know? So that's the end of news and rumours for this month. Let's move on with the show. Last month, we began a new series which looked at the different guidebooks available to UK guests. Now, each of these books have a different and unique take on exploring the wonders of Walt Disney World. And this month is no different. And I welcome Len Tester, co-author of The Unofficial Guide to Walt Disney World, webmaster of touringplans.com, and member of the WDW Today podcast. So welcome, Len.
Hey, Adam, how's it going?
Yeah, not too bad. Well, what we'll do is I'll ask you a few questions and we'll get to know a little bit more of the unofficial guide. I have my mammoth copy in front of me now.
That's great. And I have my my lawyers are standing by, so I think we're...
Excellent. Well, I'll say hello to your lawyers and hopefully they'll be very nice to me. So what makes the unofficial guide so different to all these other hundreds of guides books you can buy for Walt Disney World?
I think one of the main thing that makes the unofficial guide different, two things really. One is that we focus our research on those topics that are of interest to our readers.
Okay.
So we use reader input to guide what sort of topics we look at. A classic example of that is when we did our last round of hotel research, we took into account the top six things that readers complain about when they stay at hotels, and then we measure Disney against those criteria. So, for example, the top six things that people complain about are things like poor lighting, soundproofing in the rooms, excessive telephone charges, poor quality of beds and bed linens, and then towels and decor. So we actually came up with ratings for – or we came up with rating mechanisms for each of those things, and we used – we tried to be as scientific as possible. So to measure lighting, for example, instead of just walking into a hotel room and saying, yeah, it's kind of dim, or no, this is sufficiently bright, we actually got digital light meters, and we consulted with industry experts on what the appropriate level of lighting is for different areas. Like if you're in the bathroom or in the grooming area, we consulted with lighting experts across the country on what the appropriate level of lighting is for that.
A bit like a lightometer then, in a way.
Right, and so it's a light meter, similar to what you see in photography, and it measures light in foot candles, so the amount of light that's available at any given time. Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. It's one of the things we found out is that, by and large, hotels do a terrible job of lighting, but the newer renovations that Disney's doing, especially in the Contemporary Resort and at the Grand Floridian, they are actually up to, and in some cases exceed, industry standards.
Excellent. That's good. Good to know. So there's a tip.
So that's one of the kind of things that one of the things that that we do. The other thing that we do is it's sort of a corollary to this is we're really a data driven organization.
Okay.
So you know, some travel writers will visit a place and expound on how beautiful the trees are and how warm the jacuzzi was, and we're more likely to tell you what the pollen count and pH level of the water is. That's just what we do. So, but we do bring the scientific method to bear on travel, and I think that's really the thing that we do that's unique.
I think that's great because a lot of sort of guidebooks sort of say this was lovely and we really like the color of the curtains. Whereas you really do, you go into that light level and talk about that. This is how much you light you get in this room, and it really does go into detail. So much so that the 2009 edition runs to a whopping 849 pages. Now surely that is too much for two people to write and research.
So we've actually got a team of about 20 people who contribute to the book. We've got about a dozen that live in Orlando and are available to us on a moment's notice to get late-breaking information or things that can only be done actually in the parks. We've also got a couple of child psychologists. Karen Turnbow is one of them. We've got two professional statisticians now to help us analyze all of those data. We've got, the person who does the food reviews for Disney is a culinary professional the people who help out with the hotel research. Most of them have either direct experience in the lodging industry or are trained in research methodology like quality methods like Six Sigma, things like that. So we have a variety of trained professionals. We have a cartographer, someone to do our maps. It's really interesting. We have some very specialized people to help out.
So you have specialists in all the areas that need to be covered, you know, so you can get the best possible information.
That's right. So I do the touring plans. My graduate school research was in scheduling algorithms, and that's really how it works out. There are very few generalists at the guide. Everyone has a core area that they support.
Well, if you need anybody else, I'm more than happy to move out to Orlando.
I'll put you on the list.
Brilliant. Especially with the weather we have over here in the UK at the moment. It's extremely cold. Anyway, so in the introduction to your book, it mentions that not everything can be included. It also mentions that you're not supposed to read it from cover to cover, which unfortunately I admit I do every year, even though some of it is the same. But how do you decide what to keep in and what to take out?
That's the famous Bob Seger line, right? What to keep in, what to keep out. It's difficult every year because, you know, despite its size, 860 pages, you know, every day we get dozens of emails. In fact, there's somebody who's dedicated to answering email for the guide. We get somebody who we get emails asking for even more information, and so the guide this year we added about 80 pages and we took out 60, so I think the net increase was 20. And of course, in any given edition, something like between 120 and 200 pages get changed. It's really hard. I mean, it's really hard to decide. You'll notice that we have fewer cartoons this year than we did last year. Those are usually the things that go first. We also took out some of the speculative things that we had around FastPass. You know, where we think Disney was going with that in the future. Those are the types of things that. We also got rid of the detailed version of the touring plans. That saved us an additional 20 or 30 pages. You know, it's really hard. It really comes down to what we think readers are interested in. So if you look online in the survey, on the online survey, we actually ask people what are the sections of the book that you use, and we use that to determine if we needed to cut things, what gets cut. So, for example, one of the questions that we ask, we're asking right now is, did you use the shopping chapter? Did you use the golf section? Things like that. That's really what decides. As to what goes in, you know, again, it just comes down to where we see people people asking for information. The last couple of years, it's mostly been around hotels and tickets.
Okay.
So those have expanded out.
Great. Now, I always enjoy reading some of the letters. Some of them do make me laugh, especially I just read a few from the introduction. I think your guide should have a list of attractions that provide one seat, two air conditioning, and at least 15 minutes off your feet. One of my particular favourites, and one that makes me laugh every time I read it, is the, we think you need a rating system regarding water, i.e. how wet you can expect to get. EW equals extreme water, SW some water, and M mist. You know, and they do make me laugh whenever I read some of them. And you know, readers' letters are obviously a huge, unique feature of the book. So what impact, you know, do those letters have? You've obviously talked a little bit about it, but, you know, do you really listen to those letters?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we Bob and I and one other person answer every single email and letter that we get. Some of them take a little bit longer than others, but the idea is that we will answer every single one of them. So if you're writing it to the website and you're asking about like a login or something, I probably wouldn't get that. Somebody else handles that. But if you have a question or suggestion for the book, rest assured that Bob and I read somewhere between 10 and 15,000 letters a year.
Wow.
So an example of things that that we take into account and that we do that we add is the crowd calendar that's on the website.
Mm.
So prior to the website installing it in around 2006, we would get literally thousands of emails or letters, physical letters every year, asking us not only what time of year is best to visit Walt Disney World, but within a specific month, what particular day or week is best for any given park. And we thought we knew the answer to that, but again, one of the things that makes the guide different is we might have a hunch about something, but then we're going to go out and test it. So we actually sent people into the parks for more than 100 days in 2006 to come up with a crowd calendar. We had to measure the wait time at all the attractions every 30 minutes from the time the park opened to the time the park closed. And we had to measure the wait time at the attractions. And from that, we figured out what day of the week is best to go to every single park. And then we came up with a measure that said for any given day of the year, here's what the crowd level is going to be like at that park. Here's the best park to go to, and here's the worst.
And I think, if I remember rightly, I think I've heard you talk about a story about, I think it's your brother falling asleep in Mexico or something along those lines, isn't it?
He was doing that research, yes. Yeah. He was at the Mexico Pavilion, and he had found, like when you enter the Mexico Pavilion, you go through the pyramid, you go past the station that has the carving of animals, and then you stand sort of at the top of a ramp that goes curves to the left and curves to the right. If you look straight down at the top of that ramp, there used to be a small bench right by an air conditioning duct that was probably one of the coldest places in Walt Disney World. So he fell asleep there one July afternoon, and we couldn't wake him up. he was out cold, drool coming out of his mouth. He was sawing logs. Yeah, but the crowd calendar is interesting because that's we spend more money keeping the crowd calendar up to date than most travel guidebooks spend revising their entire book every year.
Right. Okay.
To tell you the amount of effort that goes into that, it's just astounding.
Well, I can vouch that the crowd calendar really does work. When we went out a couple of years ago, we used it, and it honestly is pretty much spot on. So there we go. There's a big thumbs up.
Thank you.
Now, at the back of the guidebook, there's these set of pull-out touring plans. Now, they're for each and every park. And so those people who may not have the book or have maybe just bought the new edition that's just come out over here in the UK, what are they and do they really work?
The touring plans are step-by-step itineraries that tell you the order in which you should see the rides in Walt Disney World in any given park in order to minimize your wait in line. So for the Magic Kingdom, for example, we've got a touring plan for parents with small children and one for adults. And it's literally, it shows a map, and on the map is a set of steps or a set of circles numbered 1 to 25 or whatever. And then below the map is some text corresponding to those 25 steps that tells you where to be and the order in which you should visit those rides to minimize your wait line. And that was actually the subject of my graduate school research. I studied scheduling algorithms in graduate school, and instead of applying it to things like package delivery or car routing, I applied it to minimizing your wait in line at theme parks, which is how actually I got involved in the guide.
Right.
Yeah, but on a good day, on a busy day in the Magic Kingdom, the touring plan will save you about 5 hours of standing in line. And I think in the book we actually say 4 hours. That's the lawyers talking. It's really 5.
Are they sat next to you prodding you now because you're saying something different?
It really is, because we sent in 5 in the text and they changed it to 4, and I don't know why. So I think they were just being safe. But it really is like 5 hours and 2 minutes, something like that, on average, yeah.
That's excellent. You think what you can do with an extra 5 hours in the park, especially, most listeners here coming from the UK, we don't get over as much as we'd like to. It's so far away, and to be able to suddenly have an extra 5 hours to discover something else is fantastic.
That's the thing about the plan. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you. Think about the plans. Everyone says that, I want to be spontaneous and I want to do my own thing. Hmm. You'll have 5 extra hours to do your own thing and be spontaneous if you follow the plans. There's no spontaneity in standing in line, unless you're gonna do some sort of performance art in the line for a great movie ride or something.
I've not thought of that. I might try that one next time. <I'm there.
laughs> Some sort of interpretive dance thing out of me. Is that right?
I'll video it and I'll send you a copy. Okay, so you've got this massive guide for Walt Disney World. Are there any plans to cover any of the other Disney destinations in such detail?
So we've got a guide for Disneyland as well. That's not nearly as large, but then again, Disneyland itself is not nearly as large as Walt Disney World. The Disneyland guide is considerably smaller. I think it's 400 pages now, so it's half the size. It really only covers the two parks. The hotel section isn't as large either. But that's actually one of our top three selling books as well. Every year, Bob tries to get me out there to do more touring plans and expand the coverage. It's simply a matter of what the team can do. We're actually looking at doing Las Vegas next.
Oh wow!
So we should have we actually have them created. We haven't put them in the book yet, but we have touring plans for Las Vegas that are fabulous.
Excellent. It's one place I've not visited yet. I'm looking forward to going to. Tell us a little bit more about toyandplans.com and how that fits in with the book.
So toyandplans.com is the website of the unofficial guide. It started out as a place for us to put touring plans that didn't fit in the book. So, you know, just like with the crowd calendar, we get requests literally every day for additional touring plans. So for in the book, I think we have about 20 or 22 plans. We get requests for all kinds of variations on those plans. One of the classic ones is a plan for people who can't arrive at the park at park opening. And so over the years, we collected all of these requests, and we actually had a database of 2,200 individual touring plan requests that we categorized using a taxonomy, using a system that we had come up with to identify, you know, the types of people that were using the plans, that were requesting the plans, what the attractions that they were looking for, and then the basic characteristics about what they wanted. Did they want to start at 9 o'clock? Did they want to start, you know, late morning? Did they want to start in the afternoon? Things like that. So we used that to figure out what was common in those 2,200 plans, and we came up with a set of templates. There are 110 basic touring plan variations that covered 80% of those 2,200 requests, and we put those 110 plans on the site. That was really what touringplans.com was supposed to be, a place for people to go get more detailed, in some cases customized, touring plan information. Since then, it's obviously grown to expand to do a host of other things. We started off with 110 touring plans, and then we added content from all the theme park chapters in the book, so that now that's the most up-to-date section of the guide. Any late-breaking information goes on touringplans.com. We added a bunch of interesting hotel information on there. We added a least expensive ticket calculator, which is really interesting. So this is fabulous, actually. It's one of my favorite things on the site. You know, when you go to Walt Disney World, the first thing they're going to try and do is sell you a Magic Your Way ticket with all the add-ons, right?
Yeah.
Rarely does that make sense for most people, especially if you're only going to visit one water park. Because the way that Disney's done its pricing is you have to visit a water park twice or two water parks once to have the Magic Your Way ticket make economic sense. Otherwise, you're better off buying a base ticket and a separate admission for the water park. So the number of things that a family has to think about when they're purchasing the tickets, things like the expiration option and do I want to hop and things like that, it's overwhelming. We had figured that the average family had to look at somewhere between 12 and 25 different ticket options for adults and kids to figure out what their best deal was. And if you add in things like all the different ticket wholesalers, like officialticketcenter.com or Undercover Tourist or Maple Leaf Tickets or whatever, you could spend an evening with a calculator and a spreadsheet, you know, and the webs and all these different websites trying to figure out what to do. So I actually came up with a calculator, and it's pretty simple. You tell it what you want to see, and it'll tell you where to buy the tickets the least expensive way to do everything you want to do. And it's actually an operations research problem called bin packing. But the average family would save about $40 by using our least expensive ticket calculator versus if they just went to Disney and bought whatever tickets Disney told them to buy.
So far the website saved 5 hours touring and $40 in ticket price.
$40 in ticket prices,
Doing well. That's doing well.
Yeah, thanks. We're there for you.
I'm hoping there's a customizable touring plan on there now for wanting to do some sort of interpretive dance while in queue for a particular
So the interesting thing that we did, you know, we started off with 110 touring plans, but then we opened it up to anyone so that anyone can create their own customized touring plan using our facilities. So we went from, and we did that November of 2007, so almost a year ago. We went from 110 touring plans on the site to just over 15,000 the last time I checked.
So these customizable touring plans are not, you know, give us $5, we'll give you a touring plan. It's a case of you go on there and you can create your own.
Good, create your own. But you can also look for other people's plans and you can rate them as well. So if you wanted to go in there and look for plans for, you know, parents with small children starting at 11 o'clock for the Magic Kingdom, you know, that took advantage of evening extra magic hours, we have a search feature on the site. You can go find those, and if the person who created that plan made it publicly available, then it's free. You can go look at it.
Excellent.
Thanks.
So, you obviously go to Walt Disney World fairly regularly. I know you've just been up for the Food and Wine Festival, that sort of stuff. Yep. What is your favorite theme park in Walt Disney World, and why?
Tough choice. Mm-hmm. Overall, you know, I think it's probably Epcot first, the Magic Kingdom second, Animal Kingdom third, and I hate to say it, but the studios is fourth. Yeah, I think, you know, Epcot to me has a certain appeal. The theming of the future world pavilions is one of subtle optimism,
mm-hmm.
Which is something that appeals to me. And the attractions are big in scope, and I don't mean physically big, but it's grand ideas. You know, to coin a phrase from American Adventure, you know, big ideas. Big topics, a little bit of forward thinking, generally presented a positive way. Plus, the rides are engineered so well that if you know how to tour, you know, if you get the first couple of attractions out of the way, there's rarely a wait after that. And I think Future World is marvelous, both in concept and in execution, for a number of reasons. One is it's probably not the best mix of countries. I think it's, you know, probably heavily tilted towards, you know, Western Europe and countries that Americans are comfortable with. But it does give a lot of Americans, you know, I hate to say it, does give a lot of Americans really their most direct contact with people who aren't from the United States. And I think that's a good thing overall. I think that they could have more representation from especially Asian countries and African countries. But, they'll work on that, I'm sure.
And of course,
I love Epcot, yeah.
The UK, which for those who may not have been to Epcot, looks nothing like the UK, really. It's just got all of those.
Yeah, I've been to London. I was walking around looking for the Rose and Crown pub. I didn't find it.
You will never find it. They don't normally exist, and we don't have piano players in the corner. It just doesn't happen.
Saucy barmaids.
No,
that like
doesn't
that.
Happen. Well, no saucy barmaids. Well, yeah. Just lots of smog and rain and very angry taxi drivers. That's about London. I'm going to get loads of emails from people in London listening now. We're going to say how dare you say that about
the
London.
Real London might actually be safer than the UK as well.
So that's your favourite park. If you know you had a choice of where you were going to stay every time you went to Walt Disney World, which hotel would you choose?
That's a great question. The my when I was a child growing up and visiting Walt Disney World, I remember going through the Contemporary for the first time in the monorail. Mm. And I'm sure Adam, when you did it too, you were just, you know, you're amazed by it.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, you know, as like a 6-year-old or 7-year-old, you know, how famous and how rich do you have to be to stay in this hotel? And what kind of people, you know, amazing people must stay here. And now, I mean, I could stay there anytime I wanted to, but it still holds that sort of awe for me, the Contemporary. And, you know, in the rooms, actually, I don't know if you've been in the new rooms. Have you seen them?
No, I've seen photos of the new rooms. I've not been in them.
They really are the best rooms in Walt Disney World. But I would say, overall, my favorite resort in Walt Disney World is probably the Polynesian. I think the theming is fabulous. The concierge access, if you can afford it, is very good. The grounds are immaculate. I like everything about it. And it's still small and intimate enough that you feel like you're getting personalized service. That'd probably be my favorite.
You also have the beach there. You can see the fireworks. You have the electrical water pageant that goes by as well. You have the lighting ceremony every evening. So, you know, it's a perfect location.
That's right.
Hmm. Okay, so if you could give your listeners one tip for their Disney vacation, your ultimate tip, what would it be?
Yep. I say the same thing every time I ask the question, and that is, you know, to plan ahead. And I'm not saying you have to plan ahead like it's the amphibious landing at Normandy, or that it's a space shuttle launch. But, you know, if you spend about an hour a night or maybe half an hour a night before your trip planning for each day of your trip, things are going to go much more smoothly than had you not. You don't want to be the person who gets to Walt Disney World and expects that just because it's Disney, everything is going to work out magically on its own, because it's not. And when you have decided you want to go to Walt Disney World, you want to do some research on your hotel, because next to the theme parks, that's where you're going to be spending the most time. You want to make sure that you do some advanced dining reservations, because there's going to come a point where you don't want another hamburger or pizza or chicken finger to eat, and you just want somebody to wait on you for a little bit. And then you want to be able to have a touring plan to, at least in the morning, to get you through the most popular rides as quickly as possible, because there really is no virtue in waiting in line. You don't get anything waiting in line for Dumbo for 20 minutes that you don't get waiting in line for 5 minutes.
Yeah, so, tell me about it.
Yeah, I mean, you're 5 minutes in Dumbo, and that's really good enough for most people. So that's the thing. And so, you know, I would say if you're going for, you know, 7 or 14 days, spend, you know, 3.5 to 7 hours planning, and you'll be fine.
I couldn't agree more. I think that is, you know, just one thing I always go on about is that, you know, planning is so key, so important. So your book then, The Unofficial Guide to Walt Disney World 2009, is now available in the UK. I certainly saw it in Borders last week, and it's definitely available on Amazon, priced £9.09, a bizarre price, I don't know why. And it's free delivery as well, it's even better. I will put a link to Amazon on the show notes for this month, so people can sort of access that straight away. But just before you go, I'll let you have a free plug for WDW today.
So www.today.com
is. Go on, have a free plug.
Thank you. It's the podcast that that myself, Mike Scopa, Mike Newell, and Matt Hochberg all do. We 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It's available on iTunes. We assume that everyone who is listening is doing so because of some sort of court mandated community service.
Yes, that's definitely what it is.
drop us a line. We'll put in a good word with your parole officer.
It's a brilliant little show, and like you say, it is literally 20 minutes each one, and you know, it's perfect for a bus journey or a car journey to work, just to listen to. And I know, so I certainly tune in every week. You know, there you go, little plug, brilliant. But you know, it's great. So thank you, Len, for coming on. You know, you've really given me an insight into, you know, what goes into this massive project every year, and you know, it's certainly the book that I'm going to recommend for this month.
Oh, fabulous. Thanks, Adam. I really appreciate it. It was my pleasure to be here.
Okay, great stuff. See you later. Hello and welcome to the fourth edition of the Disney Brits Trivia Quiz. Those of you who have listened to this several times will understand how the game works now, but let's just quickly recap over the rules. There are 8 questions. Each of those questions gets slightly harder and are worth more points. So question 1 is worth 100 points, question 2, 200 points, etc. And as more and more questions you get right, the more and more points you collect. The idea is to get some of the harder questions right, as well as the easy ones, to rack up those points and try and beat the other people you are playing against. So, without further ado, let's get on with the fourth edition of the Disney Brit Trivia Quiz. Okay, so let's start off with question 1. So question 1 for 100 points. Which ride, show, or attraction does this music come from? Okay, then moving on to question 2. This is for 200 points. In which Magic Kingdom land would you find Mickey's PhilharMagic? So question 2, 200 points. In which Magic Kingdom land would you find Mickey's PhilharMagic? Okay, then moving on to question 3 for 300 points. What is the name of the master of the Haunted Mansion? So question 3, what is the name of the master of the Haunted Mansion? Question 4 then. Question 4 for 400 points. Who voiced the role of Sir in the extraterrestrial alien encounter? So who voiced the role of Sir in the extraterrestrial alien encounter? Question 5, so 500 points. Which Disney television show was the second stop on the now extinct Backstage Pass tour at Disney MGM Studios? So question 5, 500 points. Which Disney television show was the second stop on the now extinct Backstage Pass tour at Disney MGM Studios? Question six, then, for 600 points. What was the name of the mini parade that travelled down Main Street as part of the Year of a Million Dreams? So for 600 points, what was the name of the mini parade that travelled down Main Street, USA, as part of the Year of a Million Dreams? For 700 points, what happened to the Magic Kingdom's castle on the 16th of November 2004? So what happened to the Magic Kingdom's castle on the 16th of November 2004? And finally, question 8 for 800 points. According to its history and to its story, what was the original name of Typhoon Lagoon? According to its story, what was the original name of Typhoon Lagoon? Well, that brings us to the end of this month's trivia quiz. I shall be back a little bit later in the show with the answers and a little bit more information about each of them. One of the great things about Walt Disney World is that it is there for everyone. It doesn't matter your age, doesn't matter your size, doesn't matter your disability, it doesn't matter who you are, Walt Disney World is suitable for all those people. And I received an email recently from Disney Dad over at the forums who wanted to tell me a little bit about his experiences of having to take his autistic son with him to Walt Disney World. Now, it's great to hear these sort of emails, and I'm going to read this email out on the show because I actually think it's probably useful for some people who may be in the same situation. Maybe there's somebody out there who's really wanted to go and is thinking that maybe it's not a great idea, or maybe you are in a situation where you have something to do with Disney World. Please do send me in an email and let me know about it at disneybrit@hotmail.com, and we'll certainly look at reading them out on the show. But here is the email from Disney Dad, and it reads: The diagnosis for my son is autistic spectrum disorder. This is coupled with pervasive touch and sound, and is definitely makes life interesting. He is 12 now, but we went on our first Walt Disney World trip in 1999 when he was just 3.5. To give you a better picture of the demographic of our situation, there is myself, my wife, my oldest son who is now 15, and my youngest son and his twin sisters who are 12. Good grief, a lot of you. Add to this, we bring my mother with us. She is 73 this year, and you can see that even without the autism to deal with, like most families, we have a lot of issues. In 1999, I took the leap and decided that we would try it. The kids were little, and it would be the once-in-a-lifetime vacation. I had never been to Disney World before, and neither had my mother or wife, so we were all going into uncharted waters. We got the diagnosis of Stephen's autism after we had already planned the vacation. We were forewarned by specialists that the overstimulation, all of the lights and music, would probably cause Stephen to shut down or get very upset and scream and cry. Having already told the other children we were going, we decided to ask my mother to join us, so there would be one adult for each child. Good thinking. My feeling was that if I had to go back to the hotel room and leave the park because my brother was upset, I'd put him at the bottom of the lagoon, and I couldn't expect anything else from my children. First tip is planning. Even with no prior knowledge of what to expect in the parks, by including my mother in the trip, it opened up a venue for less hassles. Once we arrived, there was the first thing we discovered is that Walt Disney World is a world in every sense of the word. I have no idea how large Disneyland Paris is, but Walt Disney World in Florida is 47 square miles of resort parks, hotels and restaurants. Overwhelming is putting it mildly. With no prior experience, I had booked us into the Wilderness Lodge in a junior suite so we could all fit in one room. Looking back, we could have managed with two conjoining rooms or, like our last trip, a family suite and the All-Star Music Resorts. They weren't built in 1999. When we arrived in the Magic Kingdom, we were told to go to guest relations and explain the special needs Stephen had. We had a copy of the doctor's diagnosis with us to verify it. The cast members who helped us didn't look at the papers from the doctor, but thanked us for bringing them with us. They gave us a special tag to put on his stroller. That allowed us to use it as a wheelchair and access to any area without having to take him out of his safe place. The tag also allowed us to use the Fastpass entrance at any attraction that offered it, as long as Stephen was going to go on the ride, obviously. This helped us to be able to experience a lot more than the standard wait time, and by keeping us moving, Stephen didn't have time to get bored or fidgety. Like I said, when I booked the first trip, I expected that it would be a once-in-a-lifetime trip. The cost alone made me feel that way, without the extra worry and stress of how Stephen would be during the trip. What I found was the most unbelievable reaction from not just my two other children, but from Stephen as well. In the park, he was not upset by all of the lights and the sound, but instead thrived on it. He became much more verbal, singing along, albeit in some foreign tongue that I don't understand, and smiling. The best reaction was when we had a character meal. I fully expected him to shy away and cringe back from Mickey and Donald, but he didn't. He smiled and touched their faces and giggled. The best reaction was the 1900 Park Fair breakfast in the Grand Floridian Resort. The characters included Mary Poppins, Alice and Cinderella. Stephen made eye contact and peekaboo and patter cake and even gave a kiss to Cinderella. After seeing how he reacted to the stimulus, I was determined that if we could afford it, we would go again one day. The other big draw to the Walt Disney World Resort are the cast members. No matter where we were, the cast members were always helpful and knowledgeable. A few even recognised Stephen as being autistic and got down on his level and let him decide if they were going to be included in his world or not. The best example of this was during one afternoon when I was very warm. It is Florida and we went in October. Stephen was upset and the rest of our group wanted to see the Indiana Jones Stunt Show Spectacular in what is now Disney's Hollywood Studios. I stayed back with Stephen and was walking his stroller and trying to get him from being too fussy. Cast member came over and introduced herself and explained that she was going to school for special education and recognised Stephen's needs. She offered to watch him while I went into the arena to see the show with my family. When we came back out, she had given him an ice cream and he was loving having all the attention. I offered to pay for the ice cream, but she refused to let me and told me she had the best time playing with Stephen, and if we needed any more help while we were in the park, to have a cast member get in touch with her. I was sold from then on. The kind of personal attention is priceless. The next issue for us was how to manage another trip. Our second trip was in 2001 and we decided to stay off property to save some money. It did cost less, but the trade-off was not worth the saving. We went again in 2003 and stayed in the All-Star Movie Resort, a value resort, and the cost of the trip was considerably less than our first trip in 1999. The big difference, the hotel. Second tip would be to consider how important is the resort hotel room to you and what time of year are you going. Hotel range by type, value, moderate, deluxe, and by season. Disney has more than the standard spring, summer, winter and fall. The park tickets don't change once they are set for the year. We didn't get back to the world in 2005. I fell while painting our house and was out of work for 3 months, so no trip. We went again finally last year in 2007. Things had changed some since our last trip. Now there were family suites that sleep six in a value resort, all-star music. There is now a meal plan, great deal, for about $38 US per person. And you can get one quick service, takeaway counter, one table service, which includes most of the buffets, and one snack per person per day on your package. We had so much food and were able to take some back to our room for later. The best thing I can say about a Disney vacation is that even with a diverse group of people like ours, there is something for everyone, from your youngest son to my eldest mother. I could have planned our vacation over the years, taken the family to see the Grand Canyon, and what would Stephen do for the trip? Even vacation is a new challenge for us. Nothing is ever going to be textbook perfect, but no matter, we know that if we need assistance while we are in Disney, they will do everything and anything they can to help us, and sometimes without even asking. I hope this has been of some help and interest to you and your listeners. If there are any specific questions you'd like me to try and answer so that you can bring them up in the podcast, then please email me. So if there is anything there, anything interesting you'd heard from Disney Dad there that you'd really like to find a little bit more about, then please, like I say, do email me at disneybrit@hotmail.com, and I will certainly pass on those questions to George, to Disney Dad, and we'll bring those answers up on a future edition of the show. Whenever you're planning a Disney vacation, whether it to be to Disneyland Paris, over to California, Tokyo, Hong Kong, or indeed to Orlando, one of the things that you need to really think about is which rides are suitable for you. Not only which rides are suitable for you, which ones are suitable for the rest of your family. Maybe you've got little kids. Maybe you've got elderly people with you that might not necessarily want to go on every single ride, who might not think that every single ride is for them. So what we're going to do in this segment of the show is just to have a look at some of the ride restrictions available in Disneyland Paris and let you know which ones are suitable for who, which ones aren't suitable, and also to tell you a little bit about the child swap option that is available. So, we're going to look at three sections. We're going to look at what is the minimum height requirement for some of these rides. We're going to look at the child swap. We're going to look at whether or not there's a health warning and whether or not there's a motion sickness warning as well. Now, if we talk about health warning, what we're really looking at here is making sure that you have good health and you're free from high blood pressure, heart, back or neck problems, motion sickness or other conditions that could be aggravated by this adventure. This also includes things like being pregnant as well. Now, Child Swap you may never have heard of, and Child Swap is a clever little system that they run at almost, I think it's every Disney park, certainly do in Orlando and Disneyland Paris, where if you have a child, part of your group, who is not old enough or tall enough to go on a particular ride, and you want to go on that ride, and there's only two of you with that one child, then obviously you can't go on together, and it could mean queuing up twice for the same ride. Well, what Child Swap does is it allows one parent or one person to stay with that particular child while the other person queues for that ride, and when they get to the first cast member, they let them know they'd like to do a child swap, and they will give them some sort of voucher or something so that when they've gone through the queue system and been on the ride, as soon as they come out, they swap over with the other parent, they give them the voucher, they sit down with the child, and the other person goes on the ride without any wait whatsoever. So it's like you're only queuing once, but both people get to enjoy the ride. So we're going to go through the Disneyland Park to start off with, and then we'll move on to Walt Disney Studios, and we're going to go through the attractions alphabetically rather than by land. Okay then, starting off over at Adventure Isle in Adventureland, there is no minimum height required, there's no sort of fear factor either, which also means there's no child swap, no health warning and no motion sickness. Alice's Curious Labyrinth over in Fantasyland again has none of these requirements. Everybody is free to go in there wherever they possible. There is the castle in the middle, the Queen of Hearts castle, which will have some issues with people who may have problems with walking upstairs if you want to go to the top of the Queen of Hearts castle itself. So Autopia over in Tomorrowland, the minimum height requirement to drive is 1.32 meters, which is about 4 foot 4 inches. So you can go on the attraction, it's not fine. It's not recommended for children under the age of one, but you can take them on with you. But it is a minimum height of 1.32 meters if they would like to drive. There is child swap available, and there's also a health warning that comes with that attraction. Big Thunder Mountain in Frontierland next. Minimum height requirement for that one is 1.02 meters, which is about 3 foot 3 inches. It's actually quite small, I thought. There are the sharp turns and drops there. There again is a child swap facility available, and it also comes with a health warning. The Blanche-Neige et le Sept Nains, which is French for Snow White and Seven Dwarfs. Interesting, it's not got Snow White Scary Adventure, same sort of title. Again, no minimum height requirement there, but it does say that some scenes may frighten young children. Therefore, no child swap, no health warning, no motion sickness. Buzz Lightyear, Casey Jr., Train, the Disneyland Railroad, and Dumbo the Flying Elephant, all four of them have no minimum height and no child swap on there, all designed for families and for children, so obviously there's nothing there at all. Honey, I Shrunk the Audience has no specific height requirement, no age requirement, but it does say that the films and the special effects may frighten some children. For those of you who have been on the ride, you'll know that there are moments where there's a huge snake that comes out and it's sort of 3D. There's also some 4D effects, and if you don't want to know, turn off now. The moment where the mice go under the seats and with their tails flicking against your legs obviously may upset some small children. But other than that, there's no warnings there at all, neither for the horse-drawn streets, cars and Main Street vehicles. The Indiana Jones and the Temple of Peril, 1.40 metres, which is about 4 foot 6 for the minimum height requirement, but it's not recommended for children under the age of 8. Obviously Disney will not stop that, but it's not recommended for children under the age of 8. There is child swap, There is also health warnings and motion sickness warnings on that attraction. Just go through a few more here that don't have any restrictions on them whatsoever. We have the Robinson Family Treehouse. Obviously has no restrictions in age or height, but is not a wheelchair-friendly attraction. There is hundreds of steps that go up and come back down again. You've also got the Carousel, Lancelot's Carousel, which does have disabled access, which is really, really good. And you've got the Legends of the Wild West, which is sort of a walking tour as you come through the entrance to Frontierland as you sort of turn left from the main hub within the park. Again, disabled access is difficult. It's a lot of steps, but there's no restriction there. The Enchanted Aladdin's Passage Ride walkthrough, again, nothing. And neither the Storybook Cruise or the Mystery to Nautilus. Now, I'm not sure whether or not there is disability access there. Again, there is a lot of steps, takes you under the ground. If anything, small children may be slightly frightened by the huge octopus that appears in one of the windows, but other than that, nothing at all really there. Same for the Voyage of Pinocchio. The Mad Hatter Teacups has the warning of it being a spinning ride, so with that, you have the health and the motion sickness warnings. But obviously, if you're in the teacup, you can control how fast it does or doesn't spin. The Orbitron over in Tomorrowland, so Discoveryland, has no height restriction, but it's not recommended for children under one, and it does come with a motion sickness warning. Phantom Manor, again, no maximum or minimum height. There's no fast pass or no child swap, sorry, or health and motion sickness warning, but it does warn that it's a dark ride and it may frighten some small children. Do look back at episode 1 or 2 with the hint there about the glow sticks. They'll be really useful for that and for Phantom Manor if you've got children who may be scared of the dark. You've got Pirates Beach, which is over by Pirates of the Caribbean. Now, for a change, it's actually a maximum height of 1.40 metres, which is 4 foot 6 inches. Maybe somewhere to take kids who might be scared of Pirates of the Caribbean, because again, with Pirates of the Caribbean, with it being dimly lit, there is the opportunity where children may become frightened. There are two sudden drops, and also guests may get wet. There is a child swap option for that, and there's also a health warning that comes with it as well. You've got Pocahontas' Indian Village, the River Road Keelboats, and the Rustler Roundup Shooting Gallery have no issues there at all whatsoever. The same with Woody's Roundup Village over in the area of Frontierland 2. You've got, in Discoveryland, Space Mountain Mission 2 is a 1.32 metre, which is 4 foot 4 inch height requirement. You're not recommended to take children under the age of 10 on this ride. Disney said that it's very fast and it does include two inversions. There is again a child swap, a health warning and a motion sickness warning on that attraction, but they do not recommend taking children under the age of 10 on that ride. Star Tours, no minimum height restriction, but again, Disney have said it's not recommended for children under the age of 3. Because of that, there's a child swap available, a health warning and a motion sickness. You've then got Legend of the Lion King, the Tarzan Encounter, the Thunder Mesa Riverboat Landing, and Winnie the Pooh and Friends 2, of which none have any requirements whatsoever or any issues, so they're all free for everybody to go on without any problems. So let's move over to Walt Disney Studios. Okay, then over in Walt Disney Studios, let's start off with Animagique. This is a great stage show. It's one that we'll always try and go to see if I can. Great for kids. A lot of black light stuff used in there. That has no minimum height requirements. There's no real sort of fear factors there. I suppose it does get a little bit dark at times. If you've got children, again, who are scared of the dark, you need to prepare them for that. So there's no child swap, and there's no health warning, and there's no motion sickness warning as well. Armageddon Special Effects, again, has no minimum height requirement, but it may frighten small children, and it does feature loud noises and explosions. There is a child swap on that one, and also a health warning, obviously, with heart conditions, the loud sudden explosions can make you jump. You've got the Art of Disney Animation, no issues there. And also the Cars Race Rally, no issues with minimum height requirement, no fear, no child swap, all that sort of stuff. I know I have certainly taken my little boy. He was probably about 15, 16 months when we last went, so it was a year and a bit. And he absolutely loved Cars Race Rally. Sat with me and absolutely loved it. There's no problems there with the minimum height requirements. Cine Magique, again, no height requirement, nothing to worry about with child swap, that sort of stuff. It's just a great little show. maybe the content is a bit more adult orientated in the story, that sort of thing. But I've seen loads of children in there. They all seem to really, really enjoy it. Krish's Coaster does have a height requirement of 1.07 metres, and that's about 3 foot 6 inches. It does feature drops, turns, and it does also spin, and there are also times where it gets quite dark. And on sort of the lift hill, before you actually get to the roller coaster part of the ride, there's quite a few loud bangs, the sharks appear. So it can probably be a little bit upsetting for younger children. But again, there is a child swap available, but there's the health warnings and the motion sickness warnings in that. Flying Carpets over Agrabah has no minimum height requirement. Again, there's nothing really for kids to worry about, I suppose, unless they're a little bit scared of heights. It does go slightly higher than Dumbo, but it does have a child swap. I'm not quite sure why it has a child swap, but it does have a child swap, and also there's a motion sickness warning there as well. Motors Action Stunt Show Spectacular has no minimum height requirement there, because obviously it's a show, you're watching rather than taking part, but it does contain loud noises and explosions, things that might upset small children. If you really do want to go and see it and you have a child who might be of a nervous disposition, you're probably better to sit towards the back of the auditorium, towards the top. You can leave the show if needs be. During the while the show's actually going on, there is actually an exit towards the back, of which they will allow you out of without any problems whatsoever. Rock and Roller Coaster, starring Aerosmith, has a 1.20 metre, that's 3 foot 11 inches recommendation for minimum height. There is also not recommended for children under the age of 8. It's very fast and it does have two inversions and loud music in several speakers that are sort of positioned around your head. It does go from standing to about 50 miles an hour in about 2 or 3 seconds from the off. So if you think you or your child are going to sort of find that a little bit scary, then do keep away. There's normally not a huge queue for this, which is always great. So, you know, if you do queue up and you decide you want to change your mind, then it's not too much of a problem. But again, there is child swap available, health warning and motion sickness. They also have FastPass there as well, which is also great, especially if there's no queue. Then obviously FastPass works really well. Stitch Live, no troubles whatsoever with Stitch Live, and also the Studio Tram Tour Behind the Magic. There is no warnings, but there are a couple of moments in it where you go into Catastrophe Canyon. There are the sort of the earthquake, fire, water sort of moments that might catch people unawares. And also when you go into the Rain of Fire set, there's a moment where the dragon, which is down underground, breathes this huge jet of fire out in the direction of the tram. Not really scary, but it may, you know, worry some people of a nervous disposition. Final one then, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror has a minimum height requirement of 1.02 metres, which is 3 foot 3 inches. It does feature fast drops, and I mean fast, and they do fall 13 stories down. If you've been to Disneyland Paris since it's been open, you'll see the size of it. It does come with child swap. It comes with health warning, and it also comes with motion sickness. Maybe you've been on some of these rides, or I know some of you have been on some of these rides. Why don't you send me an email? Let me know which of those are your favourites, which of those, you know, you would want to keep out away from, and any tips you've got for riding or, you know, getting to those rides when the queue's nice and short. Do email me at disneybrit@hotmail.com, and we'll make sure we can use those in our hints and tips section next time. Heard of this little musical called High School Musical 3 that has recently come out of cinema. I was lucky enough to go with a group of people to go and see it on the opening day, and what I thought I'd do was just to bring you a bit of a review of the film itself, let you know what I thought about it. The review will not be spoiler free, just so you know, so skip forward sort of 5 or so minutes through this podcast if you haven't seen the movie yet. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the music, about the characters, and I will include some of the storyline in there as well. Okay, so High School Musical 3. It's the third and final instalment from the original cast of the trilogy. I don't think it's going to be the last, though, because of one little thing in the story, which I'll explain in a moment. Now, it translates, I think, really well to the big screen and definitely benefits from the big screen treatment that's been given. Bigger budget, you know, better camera work. It just overall seems so much bigger. Because of this bigger budget, it means, like I say, bigger sets, better costumes, more vibrant colours, and more locations other than just the school, which is where they really use for the first film, although they do sort of step out of it for the second. Now, I thought High School Musical 2 was a weak link. I thought the first film was fantastic. The second film was just a bit of a nothing to me. But the third instalment has really, you know, perked up this trilogy again. The songs are much improved from the second one, as is the storyline. I feel there's lots more of a storyline in this one than there really has been in the first two films. Characters is really obvious as well. You can see as they're beginning to make these sort of life-changing decisions. And you know, the actors have really thought about this and stepped up to the role. Zac Efron has had this big movie experience now with Hairspray, and he's really sort of stepped into leading man role now, and you could really see that he'd sort of had the experience. Whereas Vanessa Hudgens and Corbin Bleu were both really sort of struggled to make it as big screen stars. Corbin's really done Disney-based movies, TV movies. Vanessa released a solo album, which certainly didn't do very well over here, and hasn't really done anything other than High School Musical. And I thought they sort of lacked a little bit as sort of main characters, really. Miss Darbus translates really well, and she comes across with her usual words of theatrical wisdom. But it's also nice to see the twist in it, that in the first movie, she was really sort of dead against sport. And, you know, thought Troy was doing this for a bit of a laugh and a joke, and had come forward to the spring musicale, as she calls it, for a bit of a joke. Although, that was a bit of a loose end, that at no point did I find out that they'd actually done it, what had happened, whether it had gone ahead, whether it hadn't gone ahead. But it was a nice twist in this one to find that at the beginning of the movie, four students have been put forward for Juilliard School of Performing Arts in New York. And only one person was going to get it, and Troy was one of those people, and we sort of didn't know who, and it finds out it was Miss Darbus that actually got in that role. The song and the dance set pieces at Times are spectacular. There's a brilliant moment with Sharpay and Ryan. They do this duet towards the beginning of the film. It's about the third or fourth song in, and it's really well executed, and it's just perfect for this sort of big screen musical. And I'll play you an extract from that particular song at the end of this segment. There's an introduction of three new characters, and this sets it up perfectly for a continuation of this franchise that's been going on. Three new younger students. The rumours are that they're going to do a High School Musical 4 TV movie, but it also is interesting to hear that Sharpay, at the end during graduation, is announced that she's going to stay on with Miss Darbus and help to run the drama department. So interesting, could be a link between movie 3 and movie 4, possibly, I don't really know. The songs are good, but there were moments where I felt that the link with the scene was a bit cringeworthy. You knew the song was coming, you heard the swell of the orchestra in the background, and then the facial expression of the actor changed and they started singing, and I just thought they could have tightened that up a bit. There could have been a better way of having that link between the film and then the music. And I just thought that some of the songs were woven in really nicely, but some of them were just sort of shoehorned in, and it didn't fit that well at all. It sort of slowed down the flow of the scene, but that's probably me being just a bit picky. The first 10 minutes or so of the film I thought really dragged, and I was wondering, you know, what was I watching here? The second one wasn't great, you know, have they not made improvements with the third one? Was I, you know, seeing this High School Musical 3 sort of going to fade out and really sort of destroy this franchise? And for the first 10 minutes I really thought that this is what was going to happen, but then suddenly this whole film just came to life. The storyline sort of kicked in, the audience were started, you know, were really engaged, the songs were great. And I thought, you know, the film tied up all of the loose ends, and all of the main characters sort of made their decisions. Troy, you know, made his decision between basketball and performing, and ends up, you know, being able to choose both and moving off to university in California, 34.7 miles or something away from where Gabriella is. Ryan gets chosen for Juilliard, Kelsey gets chosen for Juilliard too. And I actually think these are sort of unsung heroes from all three movies. I think they've been really good performances from the pair of them, but they've sort of been background characters almost. And again, also Sharpay, you know, staying on to go to the University of Albuquerque and also working within the drama department at the school. Overall though, The movie returns the franchise the form that it showed in the first movie. The second film, I thought, let it down. But this third one, you know, really has seen a massive improvement and has really sort of taken to this big screen treatment. I do wonder whether if the second one had had the same thing, it may have been a better movie. Possibly, I don't know. Maybe it was a mistake by Disney. But the third film is fantastic. It's certainly one I'm going to be getting on DVD. And I do really recommend listeners to go and see High School Musical 3. You don't have to take kids. There were 8 adults when I went to see it last evening. So, you know, it really doesn't have to be just kids that want to go and see it. You know, if you want to take kids with you, that's fine. But no, we didn't. But it's definitely a great way for the High School Musical series to bow out. As promised then, I'm going to play you a little extract just to end that is from the movie itself. It's the duet from Ryan and Sharpay, and it's called I Want It All. Okay, so moving on to this month's hints and tips section, and we have an email this month from Gregory, one of our listeners, and he reads, "Your first podcast was great and I enjoyed it very much. Way to go." Thank you, Gregory. "Just want to let you know that Epcot, every paycheck comes on Thursday, comes from cast members as they are paid every Thursday. So the tip for you, if you use PhotoPass at the park, take a picture of the back of the card with your camera, so if it gets lost, you have the code to get your pictures from the internet. Also, write your name on the front of the card with a pen, so if a cast member by chance switches your card with another guest, you know right away and you can get your card back." Thanks for that tip there, Gregory. I know certainly whenever I've had my PhotoPass in the park, you know, as soon as you've lost it, that's it, it's gone. And some of those photos you get to have a look at when you get back off your holiday are really great memories. And, you know, it's really nice to be able to look back at some of those photos maybe you've forgotten about because they were taken so early in your vacation. And, you know, losing that card would be a real shame to have had all those photos taken and then for them to have gone. So thank you, Gregory. If you have a hint or a tip that you would like to email into the show, then please do. You can email me at disneybrit@hotmail.com. It's great. Please, please do send them in. I am running out of tips and could really use some new ones. So until next month, thank you for the hint and tip. Hello and welcome back to the second half of this month's Disney Brit Trivia Quiz. We're now going to go back through the answers for each of the questions that we looked at earlier on in the show. And let's start ourselves off then with question one. So what ride, show or attraction does this music come from? It is, of course, from Pirates of the Caribbean. Now, the ride Pirates of the Caribbean actually appears in four parks altogether, in Disneyland, in Magic Kingdom in Florida, in Tokyo Disneyland, and in Disneyland Paris, but it does not appear anywhere in Hong Kong Disneyland. Now, this was the last attraction in which Walt Disney actually had hands-on participation with. He'd built little model rides and put cameras into small boats so you could take them through the model of the ride to help picture how the scene would look. But like I say, it was the last ride that Walt Disney actually had hands-on participation with. It opened in Disneyland on the 18th of March 1967, in the Magic Kingdom on the 15th of December 1973, in Tokyo Disneyland on the 15th of April 1983, and in Disneyland Paris on April the 12th, 1992. Now, the ride was never supposed to be built in Walt Disney World, as the Imagineers thought that this ride really wasn't a suitable ride for Walt Disney World, and the fact that it was so close to the Caribbean. And they thought that people would know a lot about the Caribbean, and actually it probably wouldn't be exotic enough for the Adventureland they were trying to create. So they decided they would get rid of it, and they were going to put something in called the Western River Expedition, which was going to be made by Imagineer Mark Davis. But on opening day, when the park opened, guests complained that it wasn't there. They wanted to know where it was. So eventually the Imagineers gave in, and they built Pirates of the Caribbean in place of where the Western River Exhibition was, in that was supposed to be part of Frontierland. So rather than extending Frontierland, they actually extended Adventureland. Now, the ride only has one drop. Now, in other attractions, certainly the one in Disneyland Paris, it has two drops. But its drop comes right at the beginning of the ride in Florida, and it comes right at the beginning of the ride on purpose. And that is to get the boats into the Shoal building that was built behind the railroad track. Now, the drop was put there so that the boats would miss the track and they would be able to extend the ride out the back of what is the park boundaries. Now, there was only one drop put in the Walt Disney World attraction version because of the high water levels, and it meant that the swampland it was built on, if they'd have dug further into the water, it would have caused flooding as part of the attraction. Now, obviously, they didn't have this problem in Disneyland Paris because the ride was built originally in the place it's supposed to be, and it wasn't built in swampland, so it wasn't the problem. But the music does come from Pirates of the Caribbean. Okay, then moving on to question two. So question two, this one was for 200 points, is this. In which Magic Kingdom land would you find Mickey's PhilharMagic? And the answer is, of course, Fantasyland. Now, Mickey's PhilharMagic is set in the PhilharMagic Concert Hall there in Fantasyland. And the 12-minute show was actually the first time that Disney characters had been used in a CG animation movie. It's also the first time that a 4D movie has ever appeared in the Magic Kingdom. Now, when guests go onto the attraction to go and see this show, they must wear their 3D glasses. Now, if you know Walt Disney World really well, you know that nearly every attraction in there that involves 3D glasses, they don't call them 3D glasses. And the same is here at Mickey's PhilharMagic. They actually call them 3D opera glasses, and they have to wear them to watch the show. And this show takes place on a 150-foot long by 28-foot high screen, one of the biggest screens ever created in the Magic Kingdom. Now, in the previous life, this show building actually held the Mickey Mouse Review. It also ran classic cartoons. It showed the Magic Journeys 3D movie that moved over from Epcot. It also showed the Legend of the Lion King show. And it was actually originally known as the Fantasyland Theatre back then, and only changed its name to the PhilharMagic Concert Hall when Mickey's PhilharMagic was placed there. Question 3 for 300 points. What is the name of the master of the Haunted Mansion? If you've seen the film or you've been on the ride several times, you'll know his name is Master Gracie. Now, Master Gracie is the character who is found hanging from the bell tower in the stretching room at the beginning of the attraction. You know, you go into the room and the lights go out and there's the lightning and the ceiling sort of becomes transparent. There's a man hanging up there. That is Master Gracie, the Lord of the Manor, the Master of the Manor. Now, there have been many, many stories that have been told about why Master Gracie hung himself. There are around 6 different legends about Master Gracie and what happened. And if you want to find out more about that, I'll let you know a little bit more information about the new book that I've got hopefully coming out at the beginning of December that has a bit more information about Master Gracie and the Haunted Mansion in it. Okay, then moving on to question 4 for 400 points. Who voiced the role of Sir in the extraterrestrial alien encounter? And the answer was Tim Curry. Now, Sir was found in the second pre-show area of the alien encounter. The first, when guests were sent in, they watched the television screen and were introduced to Chairman Clench. And then they went through to the second area where there was this animatronic robot. Now, in the original pre-show, he was known as Tom 2000 and was actually voiced by Phil Hartman. But Eisner, just before the ride opened, went and toured it during soft openings. And he actually said, this ride just isn't scary enough. And what you need to do is close it down and make it scarier. So it closed back down again, and about July of the following year, they reopened the ride, and Tom 2000 was no longer there, and he was replaced by SIR, which stands for Simulated Intelligence Robotics, and this time was voiced by Tim Curry, and the new robot had a much more sinister tone.
And begin to vocalize. Grim, grim ghosts come out to slush.
Then for 500 points, which Disney television show was the second stop on the now extinct backstage tour at Disney MGM Studios? And the show was Home Improvement. Now, the original part of the backstage tour was closed back in 2001. And the original attraction consisted of the backstage pass section, which is where you would have found the Home Improvement set. It would then be the water tank effects studio, and then the tram tour. Now, currently, it's just the water tank's effects studio, and now it is the tram tour afterwards. Now, many shows' sets were seen by guests on the backstage tour, including one area which had sets from a lottery advert starring Bette Midler that they'd used to demonstrate how they can create sets in real places through film. Now, Home Improvement was the only TV show to have had a set resident here, but other movie sets, including 101 and 102 Dalmatians, were also shown as part of the tour. Now, the backstage pass building is still there, and it was actually taken over by Who Wants to Be a Millionaire Play It, and then when that closed, has now become the home of the new Toy Story Mania ride. Okay, question six then for 600 points. What was the name of the mini parade that travelled down Main Street as part of the Year of a Million Dreams celebration? Now, when I say mini parade, I don't mean mini as in Minnie Mouse. I mean mini as in tiny. And it was known as the Main Street Family Fun Day Parade. Now, unfortunately, I never got to see it. Some of you, I hopefully did. And this was a new patriotic parade that was created as part of the Year of a Million Dreams. It was a sort of short, casual affair and would take place every afternoon during the celebration. It included Disney characters and the Main Street Philharmonic Band. Now, the parade was designed to be a little bit like a small-town 4th of July parade, and it followed the rule of the Year of a Million Dreams, where they chose several guests to take part in the parade and then take part in the actual ceremony in Town Square. They were part of the gifts that were given away, the million dreams that were given away. As well as the band, the parade itself also included dancers. There were a few characters, as I said, a few floats, and sometimes they would include the Main Street fire engine. Now, after the ceremony was over, everything would clear except for the Main Street Philharmonic Band, who would stay and play for a little while. Now, this parade, unfortunately, is now finished. It finished on the 27th of September, as the Year of a Million Dreams is starting to come to an end, ready for the What Will You Celebrate, which will start in January 2009. Question 7 then for 700 points. What happened to the Magic Kingdom's castle on the 16th of November 2004? Well, this was the opening day of Stitch's Great Escape, and to mark this occasion, they actually covered the castle in what looked like huge pieces of toilet roll and streamers. There was also a large banner hung from the castle's turret, which read, Stitch is King, and they really sort of did do over the Magic Kingdom castle. But the decorations only hung around for one day. They were only around on the 16th of November 2004 before they were taken down after the opening of Stitch's Great Escape. Finally, question 8 for 800 points. This was the hard one for this month. So I've had several emails from people sort of saying, great quiz, last question, I still haven't got it right. So let's see how you do with this one. So according to its story, what was the original name of Typhoon Lagoon? It was originally known as Placid Palms. Now, Placid Palms had been a relaxing beach resort until around, according to the story, 1955, when Hurricane Connie swept through the resort. It is the same hurricane that also finished off Pleasure Island as an industrial island. And if you listen after this segment, I'm going to talk a little bit about the story of Pleasure Island, and you'll learn a little bit more about Hurricane Connie and how Pleasure Island became what it did. Now, there is actually a crate from the old fireworks factory that was in Pleasure Island, and it can still be found in Typhoon Lagoon, where as if it had been blown from Pleasure Island over by Hurricane Connie. Now, when the hurricane came, it did so much damage to the lagoon that it was covered up and seemingly had disappeared forever. So the legend says. And it wasn't until 1989 when the Imagineers discovered this lush tropical park and saw this large body of water that was there that had been created by some of the torrential rain that had been brought over by Hurricane Connie, and had discovered this water park for guests to visit. Now, at the centre of it is a 100-foot tall Mount Mayday with Miss Tilly, a fishing trawler, perched on top. This is also said to have blown over during the storm. Typhoon Lagoon, a great place to go if you've not been, has many, many water slides, and it also has a huge wave pool of which sometimes sends 6 feet waves to the shore. Well, that brings us to the end of this month's Disney Brit trivia quiz. I hope you enjoyed it. You didn't find it too difficult. As I've said before, if you've got a question you want to send in or a comment about the quiz, then please do. DisneyBrit@hotmail.com. And we'll be sure to try and include those questions in future editions. But until then, I hope you have a great time and see you later. With the closing of Pleasure Island back at the end of September, I thought it'd be a great opportunity for us to have a look back at Pleasure Island, and not at the clubs or the restaurants or the bars that were there, but at the story that was created around Pleasure Island and the reasons it was there. And this story actually originally extends to over 20 pages, and what I've tried to do is sort of condense it down to a smaller version to tell you a little bit about the characters that used to live there, supposedly, or as the Imagineers had created them. Now, to start off with, it all starts off with a man known as Meriwether Adam Pleasure. And he owned the Empress Lily, which is now known as Fulton's Crab House. And it was originally christened the Floating Arts Palace and was a paddle wheel vessel that floated up and down the Mississippi River for 25 odd years. Now, the owner was Meriwether Adam Pleasure, who was born in 1873 and died around about 1941. And he saw this boat and he bought it in about 1911. And he brought that pleasure boat from Mississippi all the way over to Lake Buena Vista, and he lowered the anchor, just deciding he was going to stay for a little while. And originally being from Pittsburgh, he was well out of where he originally comes from. But as an entrepreneur, he saw the island and he thought, well, actually, I could create one. I could create my own little island, just like Edison did or William Randolph Hart did. So he, being an inventor and an entrepreneur and an industrialist, he envisioned this manufacturing centre and this research lab and this development facility, as well as a social gathering spot for famous people, posh people, and eventually his adventurer friends. Now, his motto was fun for all and all for fun, and Pleasure was known as the Grand Funmeister, after being called this by the US Secretary of Agriculture in 1927. Now, the boat was to serve as a home, a guest house, and the entertainment centre, while Meriwether put together his plans for the construction of the island. Now, living on his boat with him was also his wife, Isabella, his sons, Stuart and Henry, and his daughter, Miriam. Now, Meriwether Pleasure built his island, and he founded a canvas manufacturing and sail fabricating sort of industry, originally going into sailboats. And the Florida weather was perfect for this, for merchant sailors came to Florida to and pleasure yachters came to Florida to buy the canvas from him. And also during the First World War, the canvas was used for tents, so he became an immediate success. Now, the business was known as Pleasure Canvas and Sailmaking Limited, and the first buildings were said to be completed in 1912. Now, it didn't take long for the Pleasure family to outgrow their show home, as in 1918, they moved to a Bermuda-style mansion overlooking Lake Buena Vista, and this was going to become the Pleasure's family home. It's actually what is now known as the Portobello Yacht Club, and if you'd walked around Pleasure Island years ago, you'd have seen plaques on each of the buildings explaining part of the story, and the plaque is still there in the Portobello Yacht Club. How long it's going to stay there for, I don't know, because I know that they're just about to do a major refurbishment on the yacht club. But if you happen to be going in the next few months, do look for that plaque just inside the main entrance telling you about it being Meriwether Pleasure's family home. It was designed so that Isabella Pleasure could hold hundreds of tea socials, garden parties and croquet tournaments, and it would feature fine food and uninhibited conversation. And apparently Mrs. Pleasure was often found saying, "If you don't have something nice to say about someone, come sit next to me." Now, also in 1918, the former showboat was unmoored and had become a summer houseboat that would steam down the tree-lined waterways of central Florida. But it was in 1943 that one of Meriwether's sons, Stuart Pleasure, piloted the showboat to its current position and then connected Pleasure Island with the mainland with a bridge. And he built it, the bridge that was originally built in 1914 that had become a bit dilapidated, and he renovated that bridge. So he supervised building the bridge in 1944, but it was destroyed again on the 2nd of September 1954, and in 1971 the boat was restored to its original glory and recommissioned as the Empress Lily, as it is now. Now, Lily Plaza was the area directly in front of the docked steamship, and this was officially christened as Lily Plaza in 1922. It was originally built as a turning point for limousines of the guests who visited Pleasure's family houseboat. But the plaza was then remodeled for the 4th of July 1937 debut of the 118-member Pleasure Island Philharmonic Concert Band, the PIPCB, and it was conducted by Maestro Don G. Ovani. The PIPCB concerts on this site were always ended up with a piece that Mrs. Pleasure commissioned herself, known as the Fugue for Triangle, Piccolo and Steam-Powered Riverboat Whistle. Now, fully aware of the circumnavigations of Irving Johnson and his youthful crew aboard his Yankee Clipper, Meriwether Pleasure commissioned a new boat, a yacht known as Domino, which apparently was named Domino because it was his favourite pastime, and that was commissioned in 1929. And with his 18-year-old daughter, Miriam, he embarked on a series of eastward round-the-world voyages. He went away and turned the business over to his two sons, Stuart Pleasure, who pursued the sporting life, and Henry, who was known as the mad genius of Lake Buena Vista. And they succeeded in creating, well, he succeeded in creating, a Cellular Automaton, or it's like a type of computerized robot. Now, Meriwether and his daughter returned from their many expeditions with a vast treasure of adventure and discovery. The artifacts slowly took over the Pleasure household, and Mrs. Pleasure got that annoyed she actually threatened to eject her husband from the house unless he found a place for the books, artifacts, and things that he'd found on his trip. Reportedly, she said, "It's either them or it's me." So, this ornate building on the opposite side of the island was designed to house Pleasure's huge library of archaeological trophies and artifacts. Now, Pleasure reportedly won the plans for the building in a game of dominoes and attributed the plans throughout his life to noted architects Sir Edward Lutyens, Charles Rennie Mackintosh and Eliel Saarinen. This was, of course, the opening of the Adventurers Club, which happened in 1932, and it would become the headquarters of the Adventurers Club. And the Adventurers were Pleasure's zany band of globe-trotting friends. They were yachting cronies, and also these hangers-on, who all swapped these tall tales of their adventuring. Exotic souvenirs of the members' outlandish expeditions and adventures were displayed on the walls. Now, Marion Pleasure is listed on a plaque in the main salon as part of the Founders Circle, in addition to Otis Wren, Pamelia Perkins, Hathaway Brown, and Colonel Critchcow. Sunchby Bench and Meriwether Pleasure is also listed on that same plaque as the founder. It was also in 1932 that Meriwether Pleasure created the Adventurer's Creed, which was framed in the Zebra Mezzanine, which is the upstairs level at the Adventurer's Club, and it reads, "We climb the highest mountains just to get a better view. We plumb the deepest oceans because we're daring through and through. We cross the scorching desert, martinis in our hand. We ski the polar ice cap in tuxedo looking grand. We're reckless, brave and loyal and valiant to the end. If you come in here a stranger, you'll exit as a friend." Now, another building, the Pleasure Perfect Upholstery House, which was also known as Changing Attitudes, had six full-time seamstresses working to refurbish the interior of the custom yacht in the Pleasure Island dry dock. Now, in 1934, the shop was responsible for stuffing the heads of the rare Mongolian yakus for the Adventurers Club, and the profitable sideline ended in 1973 when a wartime shortage of kapok put taxidermy on the endangered species list. Now, between journeys, Pleasure returned to his beloved island and devoted himself to a quest for reusable energy and the conversion of some of his factories to mysterious laboratories, apparently, that included contraptions and constructions, including an experimental flying vessel, like a bit of a blimp, as well as a broadcasting message to outer space. Now, unfortunately, the Pleasure's fortune ran out in 1941. The domino was lost, with Meriwether and Merriam and all of the crew members having been reported as lost when the boat overturned in a howling summer storm somewhere near the Antarctic. This was in December of 1941. Now, after Pleasure vanished at sea, the Adventurers Club was closed and sealed. Now, Mrs. Pleasure died in 1949, resulting in the disbanding of the Pleasure Thespian Players and the closing of the power station, which is now the Comedy Warehouse, where they performed elaborate Central Florida historical pageants and dramatic readings, including the seminal Song of the Seminole. The canvas business continued, and it continued to be successful for more than a decade, until Henry's poor business decisions and Stuart's extravagant lifestyle forced Pleasure Island's Canvas and Sailmaking Incorporated into bankruptcy in 1955. As if this wasn't bad enough, things got worse when Hurricane Connie inflicted near total destruction 2 weeks before the creditors sail, leaving the island an unsailable mess. This is the same hurricane that transformed Placid Palms into Typhoon Lagoon, and many of the contents of the various buildings were strewn across Lake Buena Vista by the winds of change. Now, this once busy harbour community became a bit of a ghost town. But in 1987, Disney Imagineers discovered the island, and some of the buildings were renovated, and some, like the Adventurers Club, were reopened. The legacy of the America's first family of fun was revived, and according to Jasper W. Linedozer, the semi-official Pleasure Island historian who wrote the historical plaques on the island, along the streets of this reawakened island, you can sometimes catch a glimpse of a portly but strangely ethereal man, dressed in a yachting cap and natty plus fours, or perhaps you'll be sitting in a restaurant booth or of a cosy corner of a nightclub when you hear the voice murmur quietly, "Fun for all and all for fun." Now, that is a very brief overview of the history of Pleasure Island. But there were a few other things that were sort of mentioned within story elements that I just want to sort of put in as well. In the Adventurers Club's Zebra Mezzanine, there is a Turkish gallery, and it is said to be built by M.A. Pleasure as a gift for daughter Meriam's 16th birthday, 1927, which gives us a rough indication that Meriam was around 18 when she died. Directly across from the Adventurers Club is the Lombard Promenade that was created in 1929, and it was designed by an incurably romantic Meriwether Pleasure after a trip he and his wife Isabel took to San Francisco. Now, they both fell in love with the city and the back and forth boulevards that were there, and Lombard Street, of course. So Isabella wanted a photograph as a souvenir, but Meriwether, being the eccentric that he was, insisted on creating the street itself, and it later became a favourite site for legendary day-long hide-and-seek tournaments organised by the Pleasure grandchildren. Yes, Meriwether Pleasure also had grandchildren. He had a granddaughter, Katie, who converted the island's machine shop, Dougal's, which became the island depot, into Katie's custom cars. She was the first female-owned and operated auto-customising shop in the whole of the southeastern United States. Katie, who was also known as Dougal's, closed the shop in 1954 to join the Air Force as a test pilot for the only customised X-1 ever built. There was Gideon Adam Pleasure, the son of Henry, who was born on the island in 1925 and opened the Pleasure Island Publishing Headquarters, also known as the Front Page Magazine Portraits, in 1951 to publish rutabagas, the magazine dedicated to vibrancy through vegetables, apparently. So he actually created a magazine to do with vegetables. This magazine, surprisingly enough, actually ceased after only 7 issues. Also, last piece of information, and this is the one that really makes me laugh. Near the Adventurers Club was the West End Plaza that first opened early in 1941 by Pleasure himself. And it was designed to be an alien landing platform for the experiments he'd been doing inside the factories to try and communicate with aliens. But his wife immediately laid claim to the area, and this would become the home of the Pleasure Island Philharmonic Concert Band. There you go, there's a load of information to do with the Pleasure Island history. Obviously a far-fetched story and something that was intricately woven into Pleasure Island as it was built. Like I said, the original version of that is well over 20 pages long and really does go into a lot of detail. And of course, as things changed, the story changed. And the story never really stayed still, and things became more and more elaborate as they went along. That is then the Pleasure Island story. Goodness knows what story is going to be next as they transform Pleasure Island into an area of more shops and restaurants. Maybe they will keep the Pleasure story. Maybe they will get rid of the story. Maybe it will become a new story. Who knows? But we'll find out when they open the newer area of Pleasure Island. In episode 3 of the podcast, I mentioned briefly at the end about a new book that I've been working on. Well, I can give you a little bit more information about it now. Its title is Imagineering the Way, the Unofficial History of the Magic Kingdom. It is now finished, and I'm currently in the process of doing the proofreading sections, getting it all ready to go off to press. Now, I'm hoping that the book is going to be released at the beginning of December, ready in time for everybody to buy it for their Christmas gifts for people. But seriously, the process is well on the way now. We really are getting through it. But just to let you know a little bit about what is in the actual book itself. The book is designed to give you a little bit of history about how the Magic Kingdom came about, how Walt Disney World came about, what did Walt do back in California, why did the idea come about, how did they buy the land, etc. And then it goes on to look at the park's opening day, 1971, how much did the tickets cost, why have they done it in that sort of way, and it goes and looks at every ride, show and attraction that has been at the Magic Kingdom since 1971 up to present day. Gives you a bit of information about each one of them. It also gives you a ride through of most of the attractions, and with some of them it also gives you a script that is actually of the attraction itself. Book stands at around 250 pages. It's looking really good. I'm really pleased with it at the moment, and we're just sort of finishing off those last few bits and pieces here and there. I will, of course, give you some more information next episode that will give you, you know, how you can order it if you'd like to, where it will be available from. But I will also post some updates over on the forums at wdisneyw.com/forums about how the book's going and whether it's going to be out ready for the beginning of December. If you've got any more questions about it, do feel free to email me. That's not a problem. But the book, as I say, is Imagineering the Way, the Unofficial History of the Magic Kingdom.
And as the years go by, our friendship will never die. You're gonna see it's our destiny. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. You got a friend in me. Yeah.
Well, that pretty much wraps up the show for this month, so thank you for listening. Also, I'd like to thank my sponsors, Attractions Tickets Direct and Complete Orlando. You can find them both at www.attraction-tickets-direct.co.uk and www.completeorlando.co.uk. I'd like to thank Len Tester from The Unofficial Guide for coming on, talking about his book. You can also find him over at www.touringplan.com, as well as over at the wdwtoday.com podcast. I'll make sure I put a link into the show to both of those, and also to Amazon, where you can get the book. Congratulations to Disney Princess on winning the How Disney Obsessed Are You contest. And can I remind you that people can donate to the show through PayPal. You just need to send it to disneybrit@hotmail.com. Thank you to the people who have done that so far. It's greatly appreciated. Also, thanks people for your emails. Please do keep sending in your comments, your hints, tips and suggestions by email. They are gratefully appreciated. We have been a little light on emails this month, I must admit, compared to what we've had in a couple of months. So please, please, please do keep sending those in. Don't forget to join our group over on Facebook, the Disney Brit Podcast group. We've got a few members over there. It'd be nice to have a few more. And please also go and check out our new shop over at cafepress.com/Disney Brit, where you can buy t-shirts, hoodies, all sorts of things over there. There's some great stuff. I bought a few of them so far. They are looking great. Next month's show, then, you'll be able to join me, and we'll be coming from Disneyland Paris next month as we look at the Christmas season over there. We'll be bringing you some audio from the parks, some Christmas-related stuff. We'll also bring you our trivia quiz, another guidebook author, and much, much more. To those of you over in the USA or who are American listener, let me wish you a happy Thanksgiving, and I look forward to you all joining me on next month's edition of the Disney Brit Podcast. But until then, goodbye.